sit
light.
At my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Free.
Young.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Protection.
Fairness.
Their time.
Criticism.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
leisure,
health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sasktel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings with my co-host Tetende Chikukwa, and today we're joined by Robbie Humble. I neglected to ask Robbie for her CV, so I did a little search on the internet and found a few interesting things about her, which are relevant to the topic we're discussing today, but one is never sure how up-to-date internet pages are, so I'm going to let Robbie tell us about herself. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
And what we're going to talk about is a trip that you took in concert with a number of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Were they basically all, just about all Canadians?
Yeah, there was about 10 of us, and one person was an American. It was open to both Canadians and Americans, but there was a large Canadian contingent. Most of the others were from BC, but there was also a fellow Regina woman, Jessa Pilipau, who came on the trip with us as well. So.
And, of course, we know Jessa here. She's a member of Amnesty.
Exactly.
I think we even had her on the show on one occasion, at least. Yeah.
That's good.
So,
what were you doing in Guatemala?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the trip that I took was part of a delegation hosted by an NGO called Rights Action. They operate out of the U.S. and out of Canada. And basically what it was is we went and met with four different communities that are struggling against mining operations in their territories, in their communities. And all of the companies that are operating there are either Canadian or American or both or one and then the other because of how the companies often, you know, sell their assets and have different subsidiaries and things like that. So we were delegates there representing, you know, our interests as Canadians to learn about how our companies are operating overseas, and it was a solidarity trip to hear their experiences on the ground and to also, express our understanding and our wishes to help, rooted in the fact that we understand that we're part of the same problem that they're facing. So that's the groundwork for it. So
what is happening with these mining companies in Guatemala?
Well, there's I mean, there's lots of different situations, mm-hmm. but there are lots of common concerns. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the environmental devastation is very front and center, and it's very easy to see. We visited a very well-known mine called the Marlin Mine, which is operated by Goldcorp, which is a company that's registered in Canada. And that's an open pit mine, which is, you know, understood to be one of the most environmentally devastating industrial processes that you can do, where they essentially blow up a mountaintop and it releases lots of different chemicals into the air, as well as, you know, they have to move huge tons of earth. I from what we understood, it takes about 7 tons of raw material to get 1 ounce of gold. And so just the massive amounts of earth that they have to move and the chemical processes that are used are quite intense. And the communities around this area, which is a community called San Miguel Ixtuacan and Sipicapa, they're experiencing, cracked houses from the blasts that have to happen. They're concerned about water contamination because of the chemicals. And a lot of what's happening too is just the companies, you know, they often they'll buy up the first tracts of land under false pretenses. They'll say, you know, another community that we met with in San Rafael Las Flores, where a Canadian company called Tahoe Resources is operating, who actually happens to be a child company of Goldcorp. when we met with them, they they told
us. You met with them, organizers?
No,
or
we met with the community.
Community,
We didn't meet with the companies, but in San Rafael, we met with the community that's struggling against Tahoe Resources because it's an agricultural community, and they explained to us that and showed us where there were, you know, natural springs that have dried up completely. There's been about 20 springs that have dried up, and this mine's only been operating for about 5 years. And and so, you know, one woman that lives right on the border of the, you know, you can stand on her land and look down into the mine site. She told us how she used to have, I think, 35 cows, and she had to sell 30 of them. You know, and when you're living more or less a smallholder lifestyle, that those cattle are your livelihood, right? So when you have to respond to those types of drastic environmental concerns, people, that's not what people want to see. So, and there's this a big conflict as well between, you know, the idea that a lot of these people are farmers by trade. That's that's what they do. And when the companies come in, once they start to offer jobs, you know, the communities often become very, very divisive and divided because even though they're low paying jobs, some people want them, and then the company gets, you know, understands that they have more
land.
They get more land, and they have more license to operate, more social license. Meanwhile, you know, this community, San Rafael Las Flores, held a community consultation a few years ago where they voted 98% against having this mining in their community, right? And in that community specifically, they explained to us that when the company first came in, they didn't understand that it was a company. They said, you know, they were agricultural producers. They were coming in, they wanted to buy some land from these local farmers to, you know, test out new crops and things like that. So they bought the land at a low price. And then eventually it becomes clear that, you know, they're not growing crops here. They're building, they're constructing.
They're buying this land really under false pretenses when it comes right down to
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And that's actually a common story that we heard in different communities. And once it becomes clear that that's what they're doing, you know, some community members will also sell their land after the fact, but they'll start demanding more of a price because they understand what, you know, what kind of economic benefit these companies are going to be getting. And then that's where more community divisions happen, right? The people that don't want the mine there, you know, start to get angry with their neighbors who have now sold their land to the mine and let them expand more. So it's really, you know, often pitting neighbor against neighbor and often, you know, in many cases preying on the poor as well, because when you're presented with, you know, no, you know, no employment versus low paying, often degrading employment, you're mm-hmm. going to take the employment, right? You're, mm-hmm. it's a matter of your life and livelihood. So, mm-hmm. Different people in different situations will choose to engage with the company or not. And it leads to a lot of conflict, a lot of violence within the communities as well. You know, mm-hmm. neighbors actually assassinating other neighbors, kidnappings, wow. things like yeah. this. Like it's really quite, mm-hmm. quite dark. But
I think if you look at it, you can see parallels here with the way our own northern resources mm-hmm. have been developed and are being developed, only here they're a little more subtle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, one of the strongest parallels as well is that in Guatemala, there's actually a majority indigenous population.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned a lot about the history of Guatemala and you know, they had a 30-year civil war. They had a genocide that was perpetrated by a U.S.-backed military coup, like military dictatorship, all mm-hmm. of the stuff that you've seen kind of across Latin America. And as part of that, the indigenous peoples have suffered a lot. And one difference between Canada and Guatemala is that, you know, as flawed as the reserve system is here in Canada, in Guatemala, there's no recognition of indigenous right. land at mm-hmm. all. And so another community that we visited, which is in the sort of eastern region, mm-hmm. Is inhabited by some Mayan Quechi communities, and they've been struggling, or their land has been owned by Canadian companies since the military regime, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The military regime handed out these plots of land, you know, as they wanted, with no regard for the communities that were living there.
Right.
And so they're seen by the companies as squatters on company land, mm. right? Even though it's their traditional territory.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in this particular region, there's been a lot of violence that's happened in the last few years, where in 2007 the mine security personnel and this mine it's a local company. It's called the Compañía Guatemalteca de Nickel, so it's a nickel company, and it was owned by a Canadian company called Hudbay Minerals. Mm-hmm. And now it's been sold to another company. So it's, you know, the ownership mm. changes, but the processes stay the same. And in 2007, mine security, as well as police and local military, came and forcibly evicted these people from their land. There mm-hmm. was this gang rape of 11 women.
Mm-hmm.
There was homes burned to the ground, and these people retreated into the forest. And when we went and visited, we actually took it was about a 2-hour trek up this treacherous road that they have to get in and out of, and to this remote community.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that that same road is the road that these hundreds of military people had come up. I can't mm-hmm. fathom wow. how they could have gotten all of that equipment up there and all of those people. But it tells you about the kind of resolve that these companies have to, you know, remove mm-hmm. these impoverished, what they understand as squatters, from their land, you know.
And the government has given these companies full autonomy to do anything they want?
Basically, the Guatemalan government is very in favor of this type of development. And when we spoke with the communities in this region, you know, one of the community leaders, his name was Rodrigo, he told us, you know, we're very angry with our president specifically, because mm-hmm. he, you know, weeks before we had been there, the president came to the mine and was part of an inauguration ceremony, mm-hmm. right? So they're very, very in favor of this type of development. And to understand the kind of, you know, government that we're working with, the president right now, his name is Otto Perez Molina, and he is a former military general who served during the genocide, who served during the dictatorship, right? And he's widely understood to be one of, you know, the intellectual authors of the genocide. So when you have people like that who are still in power in a so-called mm-hmm. democratic government, you mm-hmm. know, there's it's not just so easy to say, you know, that you know, the government is making decisions on behalf of the people, because here mm-hmm. are his people saying, we don't want this. This is our land. We don't want this. And they, you know, Rodrigo explained to us, you know, look around you. We were in this amazingly fertile land. They had everything they could want there. They fed us this amazing meal of, you know, fresh pineapple and armadillo soup, which was very interesting, mm-hmm. I have to admit. But, you know, they did. They had everything that they needed there. And he said, you know, we have clean water up in the spring that gives us water. It you know, sustains the communities down below. And we don't need nickel. We just need our land, mm-hmm. you know.
Exactly.
And when the government is acting in the ways that they are, it's very frustrating.
Right.
Yeah. So the mm-hmm. and one of the things as well is, you know, in a lot of these cases, the Guatemalan government is getting, you know, essentially pennies for their royalties. They're getting 1% of the royalties mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. these, you know, multi-million-dollar companies.
Can you say?
I'd have to look more into the actual, you know, international
sure.
policies.
But the thing is, Tatenda, that we're talking about a very small number of people who are benefiting.
Mm-hmm.
So those pennies that they're getting in royalties are millions of dollars to these small group of people.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
So they're quite happy with the money they're getting. You know,
mm-hmm.
They certainly, the country, the people whose land is being disrupted mm-hmm. certainly does deserve more. But that's basically mm-hmm. what's going on. It's pennies mm-hmm. to the company, but mm-hmm. it's big bucks to mm-hmm. the people in power.
And which, I mean, often the local, well, and so in, we learned about this issue in San Rafael, where the Tahoe mine is operating, mm-hmm. where there's a lot of community conflict there. And the community leader we met with, Oscar Morales, he was explaining to us that it's this 1% of the royalties. So 0.5% of that goes to the federal government, the Guatemalan government. 0.5% comes to the local government. So when you start to split it down even more, then you see that, you know, that's, It's not all that much, even if it is something, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the larger, it talks about the larger conversation about what are our natural resources worth, right? Mm-hmm. And we have that same, you know, some of that same mentality here in Canada, where, mm-hmm. or even in Saskatchewan, you know, where we're not, you know, not demanding more from the royalties for extracting our natural resources, which are not renewable, right?
Like mm-hmm. potash.
Like potash, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, Oscar said to us over and over again, you know, that the community doesn't want this. There's all of this conflict. The environment is damaged. Our communities are damaged. There's, you know, now there's prostitution. There's all sorts of crime that's coming through here because of the influx of, mm-hmm. of money and mm-hmm. jobs and things like that. And then he says at the end, you know, and after all of that, we're not even getting very much money for mm-hmm. this. So, mm-hmm. so it doesn't make environmental sense. It doesn't make sense for our community development, and doesn't make sense for our economy either.
I'd just like to take a moment here mm-hmm. to connect a few dots.
Yes, okay. For sure.
Okay.
Because, and one of the things that's really most significant to me is kind of the collusion in which our Canadian federal government is in with the Canadian companies
mm-hmm.
in this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are really, really resisting any attempts to hold the companies accountable. I think there's a lawsuit against Hudbay at the moment. Because of things that have happened mm-hmm. when they owned the, mm-hmm. they're not, I don't think they own the particular company now that the lawsuit is about, but while they did own it, people were killed, they were hurt, they were basically violently repressed. And our government has done very little in practical terms. I think they pay lip service, you know, mm. they talk about human rights,
mm-hmm.
but boy, when you get down to the countries like you have done, Robbie, you're not seeing much evidence of our Canadian government doing...
We can let alone do it at home.
Well, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. we've got our own dubious track record, you know, mm-hmm. in our own resource industries.
And that, yeah, and that's a really good point. And that lawsuit that you spoke about is in relation to the exact community that we went and visited. It's the community is called Latte Ocho, or Lot 9 for a variety of colonial reasons back mm-hmm. when the companies divvied up all the land, but that's what the community is still called. And that's precisely one of the cases that's part of this Hudbay lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this impunity is definitely something that we saw quite a bit. And there is this, I think part of it is that there's this disconnect, right? We feel that these issues are very far away and mm-hmm. and not connected to us.
Jess's blog said that our government is actually, our Canadian pension fund is actually invested in the mining industry mm-hmm. in Guatemala.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Our public pension fund, as well as many different banks, investment mm-hmm. funds, all these types of things, are heavily invested in the mining industry. And mm-hmm. Goldcorp is one of these big giants that we're mm-hmm. that we're invested in. Actually, trying mm-hmm. to remember, but the pension plan has $217 million invested in Goldcorp. Jeez. And that's just one pension fund. There's also, more private pension funds like teachers' funds, mm-hmm. like your mm-hmm. individual investments and banks that when you bank with them, they invest their funds, right? And so once you start to dig into some of that stuff, which a lot of, your average person on the street isn't going to be doing a lot of that research. But once you do that, you start to understand a little bit why the government is so, mm-hmm. is so in favor of this, right? And why they pay lip service, but don't do a lot of action. And when there is this lobbying from the mining industry, why they really listen, because our economy is heavily dependent mm-hmm. upon these companies. But one thing that I've found is that, and it was one of the driving forces for me to go and learn more, was when I understood that. When I understood that something that I benefit from directly, not indirectly, not mm-hmm. Because of a global system. I mean, it's all of that as well, but directly benefit that I will be seeing, hopefully, I mean, seeing returns on, is the direct result of someone else's exploitation. And it's mm-hmm. not just someone else's exploitation, it's people that I've met, in Latte Ocho, it's, the 11 women that were raped. I mean, they're not just 11 women in a remote community in Guatemala. I know their names. I shook hands with them. I hugged them. We talked all afternoon about what they were experiencing. They have names. Her name, Rosa and Margarita, were the two women mm-hmm. that spoke the most with us. And, when you start to understand that and you start to, you understand the fear that they're living under every single day, then it really starts to draw those lines with, at what cost do we want these returns on our investment? What type of economy do we want to see? And mm-hmm. and in that way, it's kind of segues a lot, but I do see a lot of opportunities there in terms of engaging people around this aspect, around the mm-hmm. investor side, around the direct financial benefit side, because most people you talk to, we're not bad people, the average mm-hmm. person you see on the street, right? You mm-hmm. you don't want to be benefiting from something so horrible. And when people understand that they are directly, personally involved, it really, I think it can be a really strong impetus for, for change, hopefully sooner rather than later. But mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really tough issue, but one of the a central message that we brought with us on this trip was, to explain to the communities that we were meeting with that we understand that we're part of this system. And, mm-hmm. In the first community that we met with, which is right near Guatemala City, they're fighting against expansion from an American company, called Kappas Cassidy and Associates, which used to be owned by a Canadian company. So again, more of the same. But when we met with them, we were explaining that, we understand that we're part of the same problem, and we're here not only to hear your stories and to bring those back to Canada, but also to let you know that we're going to be doing everything that we can in Canada to help people understand mm-hmm. this, to hold our governments to account, to hold our companies to account. And one of the men that joined our sort of impromptu community meeting, he asked us very directly, looked in our group leader's eyes and said, who are you going to, mm-hmm. Denounce these issues to? Who are you going to hold accountable? And so this back and forth exchange was really important, because, we explained that, well, we're going to, like I said, we're going to hold our government, our companies to account, and also inform the Canadian people. But you also have to understand that It's not that easy because our government is in favor of the same type of development. Our government is working with your government. That's part of how our government says they're acting democratically, and you know, we abide by the laws in Guatemala, which are corrupt, and the government is run by a former military general who's involved in terrible atrocities. But they don't say that, right? They say we're abiding by the local laws in Guatemala. And so when we explain that to this man, you know, the look of I don't know, just like profound understanding that we also have a struggle was something that was really, really profound for me because they're facing such, you know, violence and repression every day. And so I had a lot of respect for their struggle. And I don't think that our struggles are part of the same struggle, but they're not the same. Mm-hmm. But for us to understand the constraints that we're under and to have that look in his eyes, that's just like, you know, I see how big the problem is, and I see that you're working the best ways that you know how was a really important part of the trip for me. So
okay, well, we're just about at the bottom of the hour, Robbie.
Oh, wow.
And Tatenda and I are talking to Robbie Humble, who recently returned from a trip to Guatemala, and she saw mining companies in action there. We're going to talk some more about that after the break. And immediately after the break, though, we've got some music that Robbie picked, so we're looking forward to hearing that.
Triste, se oye la lluvia en los techos de cartón. Triste vive mi gente en las casas de cartón. Viene bajando el obrero, casi arrastrando sus pasos por el peso del sufrir. Mira que mucho ha sufrido. Mira que pesa el sufrir. Arriba, deja la mujer preñada. Lo mismo que ayer, es su mundo sin mañana. Qué triste se oye la lluvia en los techos de cartón. Triste vive mi gente en las casas de cartón. Niños color de mi tierra, con sus mismas cicatrices, millonarios de lombriz. Y por eso, qué triste viven los niños en las casas de cartón. Y alegre viven los perros, casa del explotador. Usted no lo va a creer, pero hay escuelas de perros y bienestar, educación. Haz que no muerdan los diarios. El patrón. Hace años, muchos años, está mordiendo al obrero. Se oye la lluvia en los techos de cartón. De lejos pasa la esperanza en las casas de cartón.
Okay, Robbie, tell us about the artist and about the song.
So the artist, now I'm trying, the original composer, I believe, is Marco Antonio Solis. And the song, it's called Las Casas de Cartón, which is cardboard houses. And it was actually shown to me by a fellow woman who's on the trip who had visited Guatemala 19 years ago, right after the peace accords. And in her time in Guatemala, it was a song that she was showed, and it was really important to her, and she shared it with us, and I just thought it was a very beautiful song, and it's a very sad song. It talks about, you know, the poverty and you know, people living, again, it's you know, how sad is the rain that you can hear it on the house, you know, the cardboard houses, and it talks about, you know, this impoverishment and you know, subjugation and things like that. But it was also a very, I don't know, proud and resilient song as well. And I just thought it was really beautiful, and I wanted to share it. So, yeah.
And Robbie, I started off saying that we're going to ask you a bit about yourself, but we never got around to that.
Are you fluent in Spanish?
I would not say fluent. I have a piece of paper that says that I am. I have a minor in Spanish, but no, I this was my first opportunity in Guatemala to actually use it a bit. By the end of the trip, I was able to have very rudimentary conversations with people. You know, through the trip, I learned some key words, you know, like mina, mine, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it helped. It helped a bit. But I had enough to understand a lot of what was said. A lot of the meetings that we had were all translated. So people were speaking either Spanish or Spanish and an indigenous language. So sometimes in some meetings we had two translators, someone who would translate from Mayan Quechi to Spanish and then from Spanish to English. so with Spanish, I could understand most of what was said. I got the gist of it, which was really nice.
But so when you were in university, what sort of courses did you take? Did they kind of point you in this direction?
Yes, definitely. I have a Bachelor of Arts in International Development. So we learned a lot about all of this stuff. It's about poverty, about, you know, it's an interdisciplinary degree, so learned a lot about politics, economics, anthropology, sociology, gender, all that stuff. So definitely led me to an interest in development and human rights. And that's my background.
In general terms here, what's your opinion of what's going on with the departments that are involved, like our foreign affairs and that sort of thing? They're not bad people, you know? The people who work in foreign affairs are nice people. I'm sure we would like them personally and all the rest of it. And they're not, I don't think they're not going to be stupid people. They wouldn't be in that position if they were stupid, you know, and they're not ignorant. So what's going on? Why are these really indignities going on with the indigenous people who are having their lands taken from them or destroyed by companies which are going in there with the blessing of the Canadian government? Like, what's happening?
I mean, that's a big question, and that's the thing. It's a big issue, and that's why it's partly why it's so hard and why it's so divisive. Because you know, you have to look at the structures that are in place. And it's, again, it's hard to dig through all of it. And, you know, I just, on this trip, I had just read a book called Imperial Canada Inc. I can't remember the author's name right now, but it outlines how our actual, like, financial system in Canada is so set up for these companies. It's been rooted in that since Canada was colonized, right? Since our Indigenous people were colonized. And so these same structures are existing today. And so it's, once you start to really dig into that, you, you can see how it's so ingrained. It's, you know, a lot of the people that are in power, you know, I don't necessarily, like you said, I think that most people are good, you know, and they believe that they're working for the greater good, but they understand that, you know, all things come from economic benefit. Right. But that doesn't, it's not always how it works. And, when we're, you know, kind of exporting these systems, it takes, you know, an individual person like me for me to really understand the impacts of these systems, to travel there, to see it firsthand. And when you start to put a human face on the consequences of just massive economic expansion for the sake of massive economic expansion, you start to really understand what the consequences are. And, and yeah, it's part of what clouds a lot of these issues as well is that, you know, and Jessa wrote, she actually did her honors research on the human rights language of these companies, specifically in Guatemala. And that opened up a lot of insight for me as well, because it's, you know, a company can't exist in this day and age without a front and center corporate social responsibility policy, right? They say in even their mission statements, it's, you know, we strive to be the, you know, most sustainable company while, you know, while providing strong dividends to our shareholders, right? But when it comes down to it, the profits to the shareholders is first and foremost, and everything else comes secondary. And when they start to use that language and use that framework, it's a lot easier to deflect things. You know, like I said, we work with the local government. We consulted with the communities, not asking, you know, do those governments actually represent the people?
Right. Do you think it's a lack of information coming the other way? So the shareholders are really not aware and perhaps don't want to be aware of what's actually happening at the business end of the company's operations.
I think that that's part of it. And when we're, you know, people that are directly investing, for the most part, I mean, you know, your concern is financial return, right? And for the people that are jointly investing, like through the CPP, it's such a convoluted process that we don't know what happens. We don't know how the decisions are made, right?
Yeah, and at the end of the day, we just want our pension.
Exactly. And you know, one of the things with which I see as a really good opportunity is this pension fund issue. Because like I explained before, when people see that they're connected to it, there's a lot more, you know, impetus to do something. But right now, the way that, and I don't know a lot about this issue, I have to learn more, but right now the way that the CPP is structured is, as it's an investment fund, the only priority is to make profit for the fund. That's, you know, that's their responsibility. I believe their legal obligation is to make profit for the pension fund.
Yeah, their fiduciary responsibility.
Exactly, yeah. And Oscar Morales, who we met with in San Rafaelis Flores, who's struggling against the Tahoe company, he talked a lot about this because, you know, they see the Canadian ambassadors coming and you know, being part of these inauguration ceremonies and signing these you know, licenses for the companies and a big show of support. But when the community tries to talk to Canadian politicians, Canadian ambassadors, they get no response. And it took him a long time of fighting, and he finally got a meeting with the CPP. They had done all of this letter writing, and when he finally got to this meeting at their very lavish offices, that, you know, the people that he met with claimed that they hadn't even seen these letters, which, I mean, why would you be giving him this meeting without all of this pressure finally, right?
Yes.
And, you know, they say in the meeting, you know, well, oh, we didn't realize about this. Oh, we didn't realize about this. We'll do everything that we can, you know. But at the end of the day, when that financial responsibility is the only thing that the fund is accountable for,
mm-hmm.
you know, it makes it really easy to turn a blind eye to things that are turning huge profits, but at social, environmental, political consequences
right.
in other uh-huh. countries, right? And so I do see that the public pension fund is a really interesting opportunity because it's supposed to be in the public interest.
And
because
it's
for Canadians.
It affects all of us.
It affects all of us, yeah. exactly. And so I think that, you know, in this, we're in a challenging time right now where I feel like there's, you know, in some ways our culture is more individualistic than ever. It's, you know, pushing about individual, you know, benefits, and mm-hmm. we're concerned about ourselves and our well-being, which isn't necessarily selfish. It's just the way that our society has kind of developed. And so I think that pushing this issue can, you know, capitalize on that individualism, because people don't want to be implicated in these things. Mm-hmm. It's themselves, right? It's their own issue. It's their own pocketbook, but they don't want it at the expense of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if we can organize around this issue, it can be an opportunity to, you know, bring some collectivism back to the conversation, to define kind of that common good and what we actually want to see. How, you know, what do we want out of our economy? Do we want an economy that you know, is you know, makes Canadians complicit in these huge issues? And most people, if you talk to them on a one-on-one basis, would not want that. And mm-hmm. so the more that Canadians can understand that and connect it to their own mm-hmm. situation, I think that there's an opportunity to bring back some of that conversation around how we all benefit or how we're all affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, part of it too, if you, the little bit that I know about activism is, you know, and studying social movements, is that in many cases it's about, you know, waiting for an opening and then mm-hmm. taking that opportunity. It's not just shouting things out all of the time,
right.
but it's waiting for your moment mm-hmm. in time and place. And mm-hmm. because a lot of this is really coming to a head, because our environment is, you can start to see, you know, we've had how many floods and 3 floods in the last 5 years. Like, people yeah. are starting to understand that some of these big issues are starting to impact us.
Yeah.
And
Regina's dumping partially treated
exactly.
sewage into Wascana.
Exactly.
So why is that, folks?
Yeah.
That's because of decisions that were not made a few years back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when you start to see that all of these things are aligning, like, and these issues are becoming more and more talked about, that are in terms of the mining issue,
mm-hmm.
I think that it could be the opportunity soon anyways to take that step and have that conversation. Because these issues have been happening for a while. I mean, I've kind of understood, you know, in Guatemala specifically, you know, the civil war ended in the 90s. And
mm-hmm.
After that, you know, there's a lot of sort of days. If you're, you know, 250,000 people were killed or disappeared, that takes a while to recover from as a culture, as a country, as individuals. And so after that is when the companies kind of started really, you know, ramping up operations, and it took a while for the country to kind of come out of that daze.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early 2000s, that's when a lot of these conflicts start happening, a lot of the violence, a lot of the community saying, no, we don't want this. But it takes a while for that to trickle
mm-hmm.
up to the north, where we can hear those stories. And
right.
so I think that, you know, at first I was frustrated. It's like, these have been going on for a while. Why are we still dealing with this? But I
yeah.
also saw a little bit of an opportunity in understanding that there's reasons why we haven't heard it, and maybe now is the time to be doing something about it.
Mm-hmm. Is the media in Guatemala very open?
Yes and no. I mean, I don't know a lot about it, but I think that they do a pretty good job of covering it. I didn't see a lot of that. I wasn't there for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's a lot of issues there mm-hmm. to cover, but you know, they yeah I think in general they are mm-hmm. but probably, like, here it would depend on the outsort or on the outlet and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff,
who
but,
owns the mm-hmm. papers and
exactly.
that sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would suspect you're gonna have issues there.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah
know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess when it boils right down to it, anything like this depends, like resolution or improvement depends on making the public aware
mm-hmm.
of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I just have this feeling that Joe Average public, if there is such a person, lots of times doesn't want to know. You know, I know people that don't pay any attention to politics at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't be bothered. It's all bad news. They can't be bothered listening to it. And of course, if you have that attitude, the news is not going to change. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be continue to be bad news until people start to step up.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, it's a constant challenge, right? And in this day of kind of information overload, you know, people mm-hmm. do. They just want to go about their lives. They just want to, yep. they've got their own concerns to worry about too. And mm-hmm. it can be overwhelming to be thinking about all of these things. But like I said, when it's easier to ignore when it feels far away, mm-hmm. the more that people understand that it's not far away, that,
yep.
you know, we should have a responsibility to fix some of these problems, because right now in this particular issue, we're one of the biggest sources of the problem. And that you're individually benefiting from it, there is that opportunity. I mean, mm-hmm. it's still hard if people don't want to listen, don't want to know. I mean, you can't make them, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of a difficult concept to get to a person that you know that are individually benefiting from the way these companies are mistreating Indigenous people in another country thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one.
It is. Mm-hmm.
You know.
It is. It's a tough one, but at the same time, it's, you know, that's the reality, and we like to also, you know, shy away from things that we don't want to know, and that's part of it. That's why it's so easy not to listen. And I mean, there's a lot of problems in the world, right? But to step up and take responsibility for some of the ones mm-hmm. that you actually can have a say in, that
exactly.
you actually can do something about, I think is really important, because yeah. you can't fix everything. You can't, you know,
no.
but you can do something, and you can, you know, as cliche as it is, the saying, you know, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. In mm-hmm. this case, we are part of the problem. So,
right.
I think that's a really, I don't know. It's on the one hand, very upsetting, but on the other hand, a really good opportunity. And, that sometimes that's what it takes for people to change, right? Like we were talking about the climate and things like that. It takes you kind of being beaten down a little bit to understand really what's at stake,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And what that actually means when these companies are acting this way on our behalf and with our government's blessing, who's supposed to be acting on our behalf.
They're supposed to be champions of human rights.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, as part of that, we're talking about awareness. There are a few really, really good resources that I would encourage, you know, anyone who's interested in this, in the very least, to look at. And one of the first ones that I would mention is, it's a campaign called The Money Thread.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, I think it's themoneythread.org is the mm-hmm. website. And it's a resource that actually helps you, again, follow the money, understand where the investments are, what funds are invested in which companies, in which banks,
right.
so that you can start to, you know, ask for more ethical investments. You can mm-hmm. start to pressure the right people about making those decisions. And I would just encourage people to find out about their own investments, to find out who they're invested in. And that kind of shareholder activism, I think, could be really positive. So the moneythread.org is a really great place to start. It lists, mm-hmm. again, some of those amounts that's where I found some of the information that the pension plan is invested $217 million into Goldcorp. That's just one company.
Mm-hmm.
So think of all of these others. And on that note, Canada is actually home to 75% of the world's mining companies. So if you start to piece those together, yes, mm-hmm. Goldcorp is one of the biggest, but you see how far this can stretch. Another that I would point to is there's a couple films. One is called Defensora,
mm-hmm.
and it's specifically about the mining struggle in the El Estor region with the Mayan Quechi people against Hudbay. And it's about the lawsuits that are coming, which are precedent setting in Canadian court. So much so that just recently the Tahoe case they've filed a lawsuit in Canada as well. And I think partly based on the precedent that the Hudbay case has set.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in relation to private security personnel shooting at unarmed protesters. So and then as another part of that, another film that's really talks about these same exact struggles that I went and visited and gives you a sense of that. Another one is called Gold Fever.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about just the kind of the larger picture. As well as the Open for Justice campaign is a really great campaign by many different groups across Canada, pressuring the government for more accountability, to hold these companies mm-hmm. accountable for how they act overseas, and to give legal and financial penalties to companies that are seen violating human rights abroad.
Mm-hmm. I think we were all extremely disappointed when mm-hmm. Bill C-300 didn't make it through Parliament, and that was at a time when the government was a minority government, mm-hmm. and it would have been possible had the Liberals followed through.
Exactly.
And if everyone on the minority side, like on the the side against the government, if everybody had got together, that bill would have gone through. There was mm-hmm. no reason for it not to pass.
Yeah.
Although I must say, I know that our own MP here in Regina, Ralph Goodale, voted in favor of Bill C-300, but unfortunately, some of his fellow MPs did not.
Right.
And it should have passed.
Yeah. And that bill, common sense law, mm-hmm. exactly like we were saying, to just hold companies accountable, mm-hmm. just saying, don't kill people overseas, don't displace people overseas, don't do anything overseas that you would be scared to do at home, right? Mm-hmm. And even that had a hard time passing. So it's disheartening, but I also feel like there's a few different waves of momentum that might have to happen behind this. And then the more people that start to mm-hmm. start to care about it and start to not want to benefit from this anymore.
Yeah,
I don't think that it's a battle that's lost yet, even though there has been a few, mm-hmm. Those have been down parts I think there's been two different bills actually regarding mining that have been squashed.
Right.
But at the same time, now we have these two precedent-setting legal cases, lawsuits mm-hmm. in Canada that are holding Canadian parent companies accountable for what their subsidiaries are doing overseas. And that's, they haven't been won yet, hopefully, no. But they're opening different types of doors, even as small as just letting the cases be heard in Canada mm-hmm. is huge. And so there's always setbacks, but it seems like there's also some doors opening up as well.
Well, one of the most recent Supreme Court decisions is very heartening for Indigenous
exactly.
people in BC, mm-hmm. where the court recognized the fact that they have title to this land. They didn't sign any treaties, so they didn't give up the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's given people something to chew on.
Exactly.
One last question. I'm just curious about, there was a couple of Americans that were with your group. Did you
yes.
notice any different attitude with them? Were they pretty much on side with
Well, the leader of the group who was with the NGO, he is, I think he has dual citizenship.
Oh.
So he has his own opinions. There's mm-hmm. a reason why he's leading these trips. The other American is actually a sociology professor in mm-hmm. the States. And so she really understood mm-hmm. the issues and was very passionate about them. But that being said, what I know she got out of the trip was mm-hmm. learning just how bad Canada is. Mm-hmm. She kept thinking, oh, that sounds like something that we would do. That sounds
yeah.
like something we would do.
She grew up with Canada the good.
Exactly. And so it opened up her eyes. And I mean, we're acting in many ways similar. In some mm-hmm. ways, we're acting worse than how the Americans have. And I mean, there's lots of different causes of what's going on in Latin America, but the U.S. is one of the biggest reasons. That Canada supported a lot of it too, back in the 60s and the 70s with these military coups and things like that. But, and we're all trying to help try to take some responsibility and recognition for some of these problems that we've caused. But I think she really opened up her eyes to the fact that, it's not just Americans that are doing this. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you very much, Robbie, for being here today.
Yes, well,
it's
thank you so much.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Mm-hmm. I think we've learned a lot, and some of it just sort of emphasized what we already know, and we know that we've got work ahead of us.
Exactly.
For sure. Mm-hmm. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."